Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world, a woman who has chronicled it brilliantly and helped the rest of us understand how that war is manifesting itself now and what we had best be doing about it. Better than just about anybody I know is our first guest. She is a regular here at Secure Freedom Radio, I'm proud to say. She is, of course, Diana West, a longtime syndicated columnist, now a blogger par excellence at dianawest.net. You can also find her writings from time to time at the Daily Caller and at other places. We're always grateful to her for taking some time to share with us some of the insights she's developed, among other things, through her larger writings, her oeuvre, as they say, including Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Diana, good to have you back. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Good to be back.
Let me just say, first off, I am deeply appreciative of a splendid piece you had recently in which you joined the fight on my own behalf, to some extent, but primarily in support of our friend Fred Flights, a longtime colleague of ours and former senior vice president of the Center for Security Policy, now the chief of staff at John Bolton's National Security Council. You put into a larger context what's going on with the attacks on Fred and our organization to some extent as well. Put that context to our listeners, if you would.
Yes, well, this was a completely noxious attack attempting to take away Fred Flights' new job and to the detriment of the Trump administration, as well as the country. But these tactics are very familiar, and what it struck me was that this was just another typical assault that reveals the foreign policy debate, if you will, to come down to what I'm calling the national security hawks versus the national security subversives. And these are not terms, and I've described this at some length at my website, dianawest.net, these are not terms in their normal definition, because I am assuming the hawks to be all Americans across the foreign policy spectrum who are debating the good of our country first. And the national security subversives are essentially those that we have come to in our moment to call globalists, those who actually do not see America as a nation of with sovereign rights and interests separate from the rest of the world. They may coincide, but our interests come first, our people come first, our borders come first. I mean, this is the Trump agenda that the subversives are absolutely in a state of war to defeat and make sure it never rises again. And Fred Flight finds himself, as so many have, in the crosshairs of this war. And it's not a political debate. It's not a matter of putting out ideas and having them compete in the marketplace of ideas in the public square in any kind of civil, natural, democratic, small d democratic discourse and process, which is what Americans have a right to expect. This is down and dirty, which is why the word subversive is part of it. It's subversive of our system and of our Constitution. And it involves, just to get to the end, it involves slander and smears. And the worst of all against Fred Flights came from Washington Monthly in an article that called him in the headline a neo-Nazi. And this was so heinous, noxious, and absurd that I focused in on that particular part of the assault because it really is the crescendo. And we've seen Washington Monthly pull down that headline, which is to the good. However, the smear stands in the body of the article. So I don't think they should get any kudos here.
A smear against him and again against the Center for Security Policy. That this particularly unhinged piece, as I recall, actually asserted without any evidence whatsoever that the Center for Security Policy is actually involved with Vladimir Putin's Russia, which will come as a great shock to Vladimir Putin, I think it's fair to say, since we spend pretty much 30 years trashing rightly what he's been up to and what those like him have been doing. It's really the kind of thing that is so over the top that I mourn for not only our friend Fred Freites, who's been subjected to this, as you said so well, but really for our country, that this is the character of discourse at the moment coming mostly from the left and its Islamist friends and allies and the media enablers of them all. Diana, I commend to all of our listeners your terrific website and all of the resources on it. I did want to just take another minute after thanking you for that particular piece to commend you for the, I guess now, triptych you've done on Russians for Hillary, speaking of yes. Vladimir Putin. Just give us a quick overview of what you're developing there.
Yes, well, this was all based on extractions from the Senate Judiciary Committee interviews of the Russians who went to Trump Tower in June of 2016 to meet with Don Trump Jr., which is one of the bases of the Trump-Russian collusion
narrative.
I don't even think it's a narrative anymore. It's a comic book. It's so ridiculous, you know, without evidence here. But this particular meeting did happen, and it is the one of the main pieces of the architecture of this setup. And I do think it's a setup. And extracting from the Senate interviews of these Russians, you find that actually none of them supported Donald Trump's candidacy, which is interesting since they were supposed to be there colluding with Trump, Putin against Hillary. But you also find out that there are diehard Hillary supporters in this group of four. Three of the four are clearly supporting her. Three of the four also have dual Russian-American citizenship, which is interesting. And the fourth, the lawyer, actually posted a very poisonous little meme on her Facebook page to mark Donald Trump's inauguration, which shows Trump as Putin's puppet. So again, we're not looking at this force pushing for Donald Trump. We're looking at what I'm calling Russians for Hillary. And I go into the details of their discussions because it's quite alarming that they could walk in there as Russians for Hillary, and then set up Don Trump Jr. and start this whole narrative off and running. They also have, several of them also have ties to Russian intelligence agencies, which is also interesting.
Mm-hmm. And Diana, what I think you've done such a super job over all these years documenting, notably, but not exclusively, of course, in American Betrayal, is the extent to which the left has been in the service of and aligned with and otherwise enabling a lot of what the Kremlin has been doing to take our country down. And here's one example that you've really honed in on, and properly so, I think, is this business of what Hillary and Barack Obama did for the Russians in terms of helping them build a Silicon Valley in a Moscow suburb called Skolkovo. Just very quickly, Diana, we've only got a minute left, but tell us about that and how, again, this suggests that the Russians were for Hillary, not for her opponent.
Absolutely. Well, very quickly, Skolkovo is essentially a means of transferring high-tech, Western high technology to Russia using many giants such as Google, Intel, and others to do so. And many of them were also donors to the Clinton Foundation.
Diana, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll talk next to Dr. Harold Rode. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. I'm delighted to say we are joined by my colleague and friend at the Center for Security Policy, our Vice President for Research and Analysis, Claire Lopez. She brings to the topics we'll be discussing with her today, the experience of a career spent as a clandestine officer in the Central Intelligence Agency, as well as one of the country's go-to resources on a whole host of issues of relevance to our security against threats, foreign and domestic. And it's a delight to have her with us. Claire Lopez, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio.
Thank you, Frank. Always glad to be with you.
Well, the pleasure is mine, particularly because I'm anxious to get your thoughts as someone who has followed very closely for a very long time what's been going on with respect to our relationship with the Islamic Republic of Iran, and in particular the, well, bizarre turns that that relationship took under the presidency of Barack Obama. To sort of sort with you the latest revelations as to what the Obama regime seems to have been up to when it came to circumventing America's own sanctions in order to try to help the Iranians get access to billions of dollars in our own currency. What is all that about, Claire, and the larger context of which it's part as well?
As we know, Frank, not only did the Obama administration send over pallets of shrink-wrapped currency, European currency, to Iran that secured the release of our American hostages. But because Iran at this time, we're talking a couple of years ago and before that, was barred from, was separated from the international currency exchange that most countries use, the SWIFT system, as our listeners may be familiar with, and other systems through the banking system for dealing with transactions that need to be denominated in dollars. Because they were separated from that, the Obama administration tried to get American banks to break our own laws, to violate our own legal sanctions put on Iran by Congress in order to ease Iran's ability to transact in dollars. That's what went on. And to their credit, we have to say some of these American banks that were approached by the Obama administration refused. They declined to go along with this because they knew it was wrong.
Yeah. So much was wrong with this deal, Claire Lopez. And again, you have studied it closely and been among the leading authorities on what was wrong with this deal. But when, as you say, the United States government was doing everything possible, in fact, things that seem indeed to be illegal and it's contrary to our national security and so on, in order to secure this agreement, I wonder if you conclude, as I have, that this is truly malfeasance on the part of the Obama team.
Oh, it's at a minimum malfeasance. There were laws broken. You know, this kind of dealing in cash and currency and secret planes flying in the middle of the night with you know, shrink-wrapped pallets of dollars and other currency on board. This is the way drug dealers operate. This is the way transnational criminals operate. It's not supposed to be the way the United States government operates.
Right. And Claire, give us just a sense of where we are now. The president has, of course, withdrawn from this Obama bomb deal, as I call it. The Iranians are now saying they're going to start ramping up the enriching of uranium. Is this a particular surprise or a particularly worrying development for them?
The threats from the Iranian regime that they're going to ramp up or restart or again engage in more highly enriched uranium enrichment activities is rather rich. I am among those who believe that they've never stopped enriching uranium and to whatever level they desire at so many of the secret sites, military sites, they claim, that are off limits and always have been off limits to inspectors from the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency.
Yeah, this is a key point. And also, Claire, the extent to which they are saying on the basis of whatever it's been a couple of weeks now, that they're going to start ramping up this enrichment. They're bringing on stream a new enrichment facility and new centrifuges and so on. Really speaks, doesn't it, to the point that whether they stopped or they didn't stop, this deal allowed them to have the option at will to go into weapons-grade enrichment activities. And therefore, again, underscoring what a fraud it was.
Yes, absolutely. At least at some point, they were going to be allowed to proceed with nuclear activities without constraints once the terms of the agreement reached a certain point. But the point here being, that they're now claiming they're going to ramp up to weapons grade, which is above 90% enriched uranium. Now, the IAEA did know about these facilities at Natanz, and also the deal allowed Iran continued R&D on advanced, faster, better, more efficient centrifuges, even while the deal was ongoing. And so really what Iran is doing is it's just, you know, slipping into pushing the envelope a little bit maybe on what was already permitted or at least uninspected and uncurtailed under the deal itself.
Right. And so all of these claims that the deal has constrained the Iranians meaningfully and is extremely verifiable and so on really ring very, very hollow in light of what's afoot at the moment. And I think affirming the wisdom of President Trump's decision to withdraw from this agreement. Claire, let me turn to another subject, not unrelated to Iran, of course, because of the strategic relationship that has been developing between the Islamic Republic and its neighbor, Turkey, nominally a NATO ally. And we saw just this week the foreign minister of Turkey meeting with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and forging deals with respect to Syria and so on. I want to just do a sanity check on where we are with Turkey. You are the lead editor of an important compendium of essays that we published recently called Turkey, Ally No More. Is what we saw this week in terms of an understanding about this town Manbij in Syria evidence that all is well with the relationship between our two countries?
Not the way I look at it at all, Frank. What happened at Manbij is that the United States, which has some 2,000 troops, American troops on the ground in that area, working with, allied with, helping training, backing Kurdish fighters and militias there against previously the Islamic State, but now preparing for an onslaught by advancing Turkish troops, tanks, planes, into what was formerly called Syria, marching on Manbij. And the threat was very real that the United States and Turkey, supposedly NATO allies, would find themselves across a battle line. And so the talks were to somehow ratchet down that situation. And what the United States has agreed to is that we would pressure our Kurdish allies to withdraw from the region so the Turks could move in. That doesn't seem to me to be a faithful standing by of our allies, the Kurds, who have fought with us all this time against the Islamic State.
Well, and more to the point, Claire, you've done a very close study for a long time of the Islamic way of war and Sharia as a doctrine. And just to tease out for us how it's likely a concession of this kind by the United States, and I don't see how we can describe it as anything but that, is likely to be interpreted by Sharia supremacists like Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the president of Turkey, and his.
Well, we know that Erdogan and others of his in the top levels of his regime in Ankara have openly, frankly, referred to its military assault in against the Kurds in this region as jihad. Openly, frankly, calling it jihad. That our own top national security team may not completely understand what that means is to our great detriment.
Well, I have a lot of confidence in that team by and large, and I think it is imperative that they look hard at all of this in the context of, again, what Sharia is driving the Turks towards under Erdogan. And Claire, let me just ask you, in terms of this idea that Turkey really is, as a practical matter, and our problems with them, of course, go well beyond Syria. As I mentioned, Iran and their threats to Greece and their threats to Turkey to Israel and their threats to our own forces based at Incirlik, for that matter. In the past, they've of course have essentially surrounded them and turned off the power there. Is it advisable, in your judgment, for the United States government to be transferring our top-of-the-line F-35 fighters to Turkey under these circumstances?
I'm glad you brought that up, Frank. No, absolutely not. I know that there is attention being given to this potential deal in Congress. We would hope that the Trump administration would realize, indeed, that Turkey is not really an ally anymore and should not have any access to these top-of-the-line F-35 fighter jets.
Claire Lopez, thank you so much for your terrific work at the Center for Security Policy and for our government over many years. Keep it up. I know you will. Come back to us again very soon, if you will. Next up, we'll speak with Hans von Spakovsky about an important anniversary and what's coming up on the illegal alien front. Political power where it does not belong, right after this.
Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being from time to time, by Hans von Spakovsky, one of the country's preeminent experts on, well, a whole host of things, really, but election fraud and the results thereof, immigration issues. Well, I think of it as generally sort of the nexus of the national interest, national security, in particular with the law. He is a man with considerable experience in government, as well as these days as a senior legal fellow in the Heritage Foundation's Edwin Meese Center for Legal and Judicial Studies. But we take advantage of his expertise in places like the Federal Election Commission, where he served for 2 years as a member, and also in the Department of Justice, where he served as a counsel to the Assistant Attorney General for Civil Rights. Hans, it's great to have you back. Welcome. Thanks so much for taking some time.
Sure. It's always good to talk to you, Frank.
You had an important memorial, I guess, the other day about D-Day being one of the important things that happened on the 6th of June. And I want to ask you about one other that got a lot less attention that was extremely consequential as well. Remind us about the other anniversary.
Sure. It was the Battle of Belleau Wood, and it took place 100 years ago, beginning on June 6th. And this was World War One, and it was the Marines being sent in to try to turn back a German advance. And a lot of people, you know, people know a lot about World War Two. They've kind of forgotten about World War One, but they don't understand that in the spring of 1918, the Germans launched their biggest offensive since the war had started. They had all these new divisions they could swing into the war because of the Russian Revolution had withdrawn Russia from the Eastern Front. And the British Army got pushed back. The French Army collapsed. And thank goodness the Americans had gotten there. So they sent the Marines in to attack four German divisions at Belleau Woods, only 40 miles north of Paris. That's how far the Germans had gotten. And the Marines put on this fierce, ferocious battle. They lost more men in that one battle than they had lost in every fight they had been in since their founding combined. But they won. Started June 6th. They fought for 3 weeks. They were so ferocious that the Germans called them the hounds from hell. And that became the German translation became devil dogs in English. And that's why that's the moniker the Marines adopted for themselves. And it's all because of that battle.
Yeah. Well, thank you again for calling this to mind, because it was a war that was so horrific in all of its particulars. But this moment, which really helped bring it to an end, was critical and deserves our noting. Let me turn to another more contemporary issue that you've been involved with for some time, Hans, both as a member of the Federal Election Commission. You've also been involved with President Trump's now unfortunately aborted effort to look into election integrity. But talk a little bit about this lawsuit that the state of Alabama has filed that really highlights why there is such a potent pressure by the left to maintain open borders and the immigration of large numbers of illegal aliens.
Sure. Alabama has filed this lawsuit that really hasn't gotten a lot of media attention, and it's against the Census Bureau. And what they're saying, in essence, is that because the Census Bureau includes illegal aliens in their count of the population of the United States, that when, after the census, they do apportionment, you know, apportionment is when they redistribute the number of members of the House of Representatives each state has. States that have more illegal aliens get more members of Congress than they deserve. And because of that, states like California is estimated to have anywhere between 4 and 6 members of Congress that they would not have if illegal aliens weren't included in the mix. And they say, Alabama says, this is not only unconstitutional because it deprives other states like Alabama that don't have a lot of illegal aliens of members of Congress, but it also affects the presidential election. The reason being that, remember, we have an electoral college vote system, and the number of electoral college votes that each state has depends on how big their congressional delegation is. And Alabama says, look, this also gives states like California an incentive to obstruct federal immigration law, to create sanctuary policies, because the more illegal aliens they have, the greater their political power in Congress. Besides the fact that, you know, a lot of money, federal money, gets distributed based on the population of a state. And so Alabama is getting deprived of their share of federal funds, too.
So this doesn't really go to the point of whether these aliens are illegally voting and thereby skewing outcomes of elections in ways that are improper. But this simply speaks to the fact that they're here at all and their heads are being counted, that is having these political ramifications. It's fascinating and very worrying. Where does this lawsuit stand at the moment, Hans?
They only filed it 3 weeks ago in the federal district court in northern Alabama, so it will they'll have to try it there. I have no doubt it will be appealed, and then I'm pretty sure it's going to end up at the U.S. Supreme Court, because in our entire history, this issue has never been decided. Does the census, is it unconstitutional for the census to include illegal aliens? So it's going to end up at the Supreme Court, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, well, can't happen soon enough as far as I can tell. Hans, let me turn to another matter that you've also been tracking and informed by your own experience in the Department of Justice. I'm sure that there's a lot of what you're watching that must be infuriating and deeply troubling as an alumnus of an important law enforcement institution. Namely, what's been playing out and what apparently is going to come to light shortly as a result of this Inspector General look at the whole Hillary Clinton email scandal and what has flowed from it in the hands of people like, Andrew McCabe and Jim Comey and Peter Strzok and so on. Give us your read on what's happening in all of this at the moment.
Well, the Inspector General is looking at how the FBI and DOJ officials handled the Clinton email investigation. And I assume that unless he pulls his punches, he's going to be pretty tough on people like James Comey and others, and he should be. Will he be tough enough? That I don't know. What we do know about that whole investigation is that they frequently broke Department of Justice rules and regulations. The best example of that is how, look, it's the FBI's job to investigate. They then send the results of their investigation to the Department of Justice, who decides whether or not there's enough evidence to prosecute someone. As you know, that didn't happen in this case because what happened, James Comey held a press conference in which he said, oh, well, we don't think there's enough evidence.
No prosecutor would take this up.
Right. Well, he's not the prosecutor, and that was not his job. And the other thing that I know about that is that he was wrong. I mean, he didn't even get the legal standard correct. He said that, well, she didn't have the intent required to break the law. Well, the federal law in question, which applies to the mishandling of classified information, it's a gross negligence standard. So there doesn't have to be an intent to break the law. law, you just have to have been grossly negligent in the way you handle the classified information. And I would in a heartbeat take a case in which somebody was passing classified information over their home computer, because everybody knows that was, of course, grossly negligent. So he pretty clearly made a political partisan decision that had nothing to do with the merits of the case.
Yeah. This was, unfortunately, and I gather this is what we expect to come out of the IG's investigation, not the only example of politicized decision-making and practice in the Department of Justice under the Obama administration. You've, in fact, written a book about the subject of Eric Holder's Justice Department entitled Obama's Enforcer. And Hans, I'm assuming that much of what you're describing here has its antecedents in decisions and practices embraced by Eric Holder. There is a report circulating at the moment, and I wanted to get your reaction to it, knowing that you've studied this guy carefully, that Eric Holder is now contemplating a run for the presidency in 2020. How would you assess the, not just the prospects, but the possibility of such a thing?
Well, that would just be terrible if he actually did that and won. Let's not forget, he was the first and only U.S. Attorney General held in contempt by the U.S. House of Representatives. Why? Because he refused to provide information to them when they were investigating Operation Fast and Furious, which was probably the most reckless law enforcement operation ever stupidly conducted by the Department of Justice, an operation that resulted in the death of an American Border Patrol agent and the deaths of, we can't even count how many Mexicans citizens, because they, in essence, facilitated the flow of weapons across the U.S. border into the hands of a Mexican drug cartel.
And what was the rationale for doing this again?
Well, supposedly they wanted to show how straw buyers for these Mexican drug cartels were easily obtaining weapons in the U.S. and then getting them across the border. But there were numerous instances that came out afterwards where the gun sellers in the U.S. didn't want to sell these weapons. They knew there was something wrong. And it was the Justice Department who went in and said, oh, no, go ahead and sell them anyway. We're going to track them into Mexico and then we'll prosecute. But they didn't track them into Mexico. So the whole very beginning of this was wrong, because the sellers, the people with the gun shops, they didn't want to sell these weapons. They knew there was something wrong. I think this was political. You recall that at the time, Eric Holder and others had gone to Mexico and had claimed that Mexico's whole problem was all these weapons coming in from the U.S., which was the data showed that simply wasn't true, that only a tiny percentage of weapons used in crimes in Mexico actually came from the U.S.
Yeah. Well, just one example of the politicization of the Justice Department under Eric Holder. If he does run for president, I warrant you will probably have a full employment program on Hans Bukowski. Let's hope it doesn't come to that. You've got plenty of other important work to do, which we're grateful for you doing at the Heritage Foundation and for joining us from time to time to discuss it. Come back to us again, if you would, very soon. Next up, Russ Allen joins us. We'll talk about Venezuela right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, I'm very happy to say, by Russ Dallin, one of the go-to guys for us and for much of the world on matters involving Latin America. He is the president and editor-in-chief of the Latin American Herald Tribune. He is also an attorney by training and a capitalist in the best sense of the word, with Caracas Capital. He is a man who has been covering this particular beat of the Western Hemisphere with great effect, and it's always a privilege to have a chance to pick his brains. Welcome back, Russ. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Secretary Gaffney. It's always a didactic pleasure to take on your Socratic method of teasing out the most important things in Latin America.
Thank you. Well, listen, the subject of the moment, of course, is Venezuela, Russ, and you have been tracking closely what is actually evident there, of course, but also what's going on behind the scenes, and I'm anxious to get your read on both.
So Venezuela continues to deteriorate, as you've been highlighting for a year. It's one of those things I get often asked, when will it hit bottom? And the problem is that countries just don't hit bottom. Like Somalia, they just kind of drag along and never resolve these things until there's a governmental change or an international force to stop that inertia. Venezuela has people starving. People are making less than $2 a month at jobs they've been working at their whole life, which provided at one point great incomes. They have the largest oil supply in the reserves in the world, and yet they're on the brink of starvation. People are fleeing the country on foot, flooding into Colombia by the millions, by the millions.
I've just come back from Peru, Russ, and heard of hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans who are now in that country. And I know that's a fraction of what's taking place in its neighboring states. The cumulative effect of all of this is, of course, a humanitarian disaster. Some have said it's unprecedented in the history of Latin America. Where did Vice President Pence try to take this in connection with meetings of the Organization of American States here in Washington this week?
Well, the U.S. brought out the big guns, including Vice President Pence, who hosted 22 nations from the OAS that were supporting the U.S. and the rest of the right-thinking world on having sanctions on Venezuela and actually having them suspended from the OAS because of a breach of democratic order. It was a triumph for the lawyers who drafted the resolution, which we can go into, but it was a failure diplomatically for the United States because the resolution passed by a majority vote of 19, but to suspend Venezuela, which had actually been the purpose, it takes 24 votes. So at only 19, we were five short of the two-thirds majority necessary to suspend Venezuela. And we were unable to garner that in over several years of diplomacy to be able to force Venezuela out of the OAS and make an example of it for what these communist narco traffickers have done to this country.
Yeah, and are doing, alas. And Russ Stalin, so I'm clear, the obvious supporters of Venezuela in the Organization of American States are, I assume, Cuba and Ortega's regime in Nicaragua. Who else would have voted for this horrific regime?
The vote was 19-4, four against, and those were the Venezuela, Bolivia, St. Vincent and the Grenadines, and Dominica, which is kind of a triumph because you're right, there wasn't Nicaragua in that, and there wasn't Ecuador. But abstaining, which affects the vote, which is just, was not voting for Venezuela, but essentially ends up being a vote for Venezuela because it stops them from being suspended, was Ecuador, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Haiti, who we've given so much aid to, Belize, St. Kitts and Nevis, Trinidad and Tobago, Antigua and Barbuda, Suriname, Uruguay, and Grenada, all voted to abstain, basically helping Venezuela not be suspended.
So these are nations, most of them small and impoverished, I think it's fair to say, that have presumably benefited from the largesse, at least in the past, of Maduro and before him, Hugo Chavez. Is that the explanation for why they would be lending their support effectively, if not explicitly, to propping up this monstrous regime at such a moment?
It's one of the reasons there is some communist ideological affinity in that they are in the same orbit of Cuba, especially from Dominica and some of those smaller states, and they're all very small. I mean, these are nations of less than 100,000 people who have the same vote as Brazil, the United States, and Canada and Mexico, which are which have hundreds of millions of people. So it's a little bit ridiculous, but it makes them a lot easier to buy or to have damaging videotape of them doing things that they shouldn't be doing, perhaps.
Right. Yeah. compromising them, in other words, to keep them on the plantation. So, Russ, where does this leave us? One of the things that we've talked about in the past and that I continue to think is required, really, is a ratcheting up of sanctions in the decisive way that an oil embargo and preventing the not just the sale of Venezuelan oil, but their access to refined oil products like gasoline. Is that really what's needed now? And if so, how do we get there from here?
It is on the table still. But, you know, as you and I have discussed, and philosophers often repeat, while your opponent is shooting themselves in the foot, don't interrupt them. Venezuela is stompling and stifling its own oil production, so much so that right now it's producing less than 1.4 million barrels a day. When Chavez came into office in 98, they were producing 3.5 million barrels a day. So instead of going up where they should have been 6 to 8 million, they're actually below half of what they were producing after 15 years of communism. They're shooting themselves in the foot. They're digging their own grave.
So are you suggesting that it's no longer needed to prevent that oil, such as it is, from reaching international markets? They're still, I assume, critically dependent upon whatever money is generated by those sales, are they not, the Maduro regime?
They are. They're very much dependent on what's left, and they're already defaulting on their loans now to China, and they notified China last week that they wouldn't be able to even send the required amount to service their $65 billion in debt. The Russians are also they're also using some of that oil to go for the Russians. They use it domestically. So that 1.4 is not what they export. They use about 300 to 400,000 barrels a day domestically, just where they give away gas for free. It's the cheapest gas in the world. But then they have to pay China back, Russia back. So they don't have very much to actually sell for cash, and that's the real fix that they're in. So the problem with sanctioning oil and blocking them from U.S. markets is that, number one, they don't have that much to actually sell, although we're their best customer. But there's so much, such a humanitarian disaster. If we do something like that now, they'll be able to blame it all on the United States. I mean, which was what Cuba did, you know, made a living off the U.S. blockades, being responsible for all of their evils, besides the fact that the rest of the world could trade with them.
But let's be clear, this is a disaster that has already, before we've done anything, had the most dire of effects, as you said, Russ Allen. And it seems to me that we're really at a point where if there is anything else that can be done to essentially deprive this regime of whatever resources it's still using to prop itself up, it must be done. And the narco-trafficking piece of it is another, and we'll be talking more about that with you, I know, in the next few days, as we will also about the upcoming runoff in Colombia, a nation afflicted by a lot of these Venezuelan refugees, and now in a tremendously important contest between a robust conservative and a former guerrilla. So more on that with you, I hope, next week, Russ Allen. But in the meantime, thank you so much for the great work you do at the Latin American Herald Tribune and, of course, at Caracas Capital. And I hope we'll have a chance to visit with you at length next week. And I hope as well that we'll talk with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.